Our next guest, this is who you want to pull the truck over, because Edward Ring is one of the best when it comes to water, oil, and gas in California. He is amazing. Edward Ring is the Director of Water and Energy Policy at California Policy Center. Edward, how are you today?
Doing fine, Nick. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to ask you the most important question right from the get-go, because this is a huge election year. The governor, we're going to have a new governor. And I know, I think you've talked, Steve Hilton has mentioned that you're talking to him. How important is it this year we get a right person in charge for water and oil and gas?
Well, it couldn't be any more important. I mean, every year this seems to get a little bit worse. So, you know, that's kind of a rhetorical question. It's very important, Nick. We really need to change things in Sacramento.
No question about it. We're talking with Edward Ring, the Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. Well, do you want to start with water, oil, and gas? Because they're both definitely need some love.
We can start with either one. I mean, why don't we start with water? I think you brought that up first.
Yeah, you've mentioned before that dredging the Delta is a huge factor for California, from not only for farming, for people in California, but also for the fish. We can make everyone happy, but sometimes it seems like a lot of people that love fish don't want to share.
Yeah, it's gotten out of hand, and I think that a lot of the studies that are in existence that have been relied on by the Department of Water Resources are not balanced. I think anybody who's been around academia and around NGOs, you know, for a while, you know, even just on the outside looking in, you have the ability to generate almost anything you want when you commission a study. And it's very unusual for somebody who funds a study to have an expectation that the findings that study is going to reveal are completely contrary to what they were hoping they would reveal. You know, I don't want to sound cynical about it, but that's sort of reality. So what we need are wildlife biologists and, you know, hydrologists to get involved and look at the Delta and confirm what people who actually work there and have lived there for generations are telling us, which is these habitats are degraded because we can't dredge anymore. And that has to be confirmed by, I guess, more than just the knowledge of the people who live there, because we're not getting that recognition from the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I think they're wrong to not want to look at this with a more balanced perspective, because they might be very surprised by what they determine. It's true that you want to have some shallow habitat for hatcheries and to protect young fish and to create the food sources for fish. But it's also true that you have to have water that isn't stagnant all the way through many of the secondary channels in the Delta. You have to have flow so that you're able to assist the salmon, for example, to migrate, because they want deeper, cooler water. You also, the turbidity that you get from dredging is actually helpful for fish like smelt, because they hide from predators in the water when you stir up some of that. And all of these points are things that I hear when I talk to people in the Delta, but I don't see validated by any formal analysis. And that's too bad, and that needs to change. You know, the farming business, I don't know how much they spend on marketing every year. It's got to be $250 million or more. They need to allocate some of that money to wildlife biologists to have a good look at this and prepare some counterpoints to what the conventional wisdom in the bureaucracy seems to be.
And Edward, why do you think that disconnect exists? You know, we've had some strong water years recently, yet we still have, you know, uncertainty with allocation. We still aren't getting the water we need. What do you think is causing that disconnect?
Well, you know, that's the trillion-dollar question. I think that there's an entrenched bias in the bureaucracies. They come out of the environmentalist academia, and a lot of them don't have a lot of field experience anymore, and they've been trained to consider that the footprint of civilization is unsustainable. They've been trained to view businesses, private businesses, as inherently exploitative, And so when you have environmentalists that have been fighting the same fight for very, you know, for a generation or more, telling them that this is how it has to be, they're not prone to questioning that. And so you have a culture inside the bureaucracies that's, you know, I don't want to overgeneralize, but they're kind of anti-business. That translates to anti-ag. You know, they're always quick to use the cliche big ag. And they're also, they have a perception of what's right for the environment that doesn't recognize how things have changed. And I think that's a big part of it, because 50 years ago, everybody says the Delta's habitats began to degrade because they were pumping the water in greater volumes, of course, because that's when the State Water Project was completed. But the other thing that happened at the same time is they stopped dredging. We dredged in the Delta for 100 years, ever since it was channelized in the 1800s, and it never harmed the fish. So you have to ask the question, which is it? What is it that's hurting the fish more, the fact that we're pumping water south or the fact that we stopped dredging? Because once we changed the nature of the Delta by channelizing it, by building all these levees, the reason that the Delta maintained its health as an ecosystem for salmon was because we weren't allowing the silt that would be getting stuck in those channels once they were created from accumulating. And that's over. That's been over for 50 years, and it's getting worse and worse. And what you've got in the southern Delta is channels that are so shallow now that when the pumps are turned on, some of them dry up. The water level is only a foot deep in some cases, or maybe a couple of feet or less than that. And when they turn on the pumps, it just, you know, it reverses the current. It sucks all the water into the pumps, and there's no water for the farmers in the Delta to irrigate their fields. You know, and that's not fair to them either, obviously, but it's also very harmful to the environment. Those channels were 8 to 10 to 12 feet deep historically, and that's what they need to be restored to.
We're talking with Edward Ring. He is the Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. He is the water master. There's no question about it. Well, Edward, the next governor, and I know you've talked to Steve Hilton, you'll probably be on his team if he's the new governor. What if we don't get the right governor in? Is anything going to change for the future?
Well, it's a matter of degree. I think that there's recognition. I think there's actually growing bipartisan recognition that we do have to start dredging in the Delta. The problem is the process is still going to be completely, you know, gummed up by all of the opposition that will still exist. So, you know, you need a governor that's willing to be aggressive enough, for example, to fire the head of every single agency that gets in the way and is willing to terminate the board membership. I think the governor usually has control over one third of the members of most of these oversight boards for the agencies. And then the governor's appointee, the Secretary of Natural Resources, I think has control over another third. Now, this varies from agency to agency, but the point I'm making is the governor, if they choose to, has a lot of power. And I am skeptical that a Democratic governor is going to be willing to take steps that would be that dramatic. Yeah, and then you might get governors like, you know, Tom Steyer is one of the most dangerous men in American politics. He's hired a very good campaign manager. He knows those people know what they're doing. They're not squandering $100 million the way Meg Whitman did. They are spending it wisely. And that's why he's bought himself from obscurity to being one of the front runners. And if that man becomes governor of this state, you're not going to have any kind of abundance mentality. He talks about it. He's a dangerous man. He talks about how he's going to make utilities compete and how he's going to hold corporations accountable. Tom Steyer epitomizes hedge funds and corporations. That's how he made all his money, and now he's disavowing all of that. But what he's really doing is going to channel all of that hedge fund investment into a very limited set of solutions: infill housing, you know, next to transit districts, water rationing, so investing in dual meters so that people will have to, you know, pay a bill based on their outdoor water budget and their indoor water budget. Everything's going to be rationed. It'll take millions of acres of farmland, probably out of production, in order to flow more water through the delta. I can't see anything about Tom Steyer that's going to be good. But that guy has a really good campaign strategy. And it's incredibly cynical. He's gone ahead and made himself the ally of the most powerful left-wing forces in the state. Special interests like the public sector unions. I don't know if he got the endorsement of the teachers union, but he got the endorsement of AFSCME, and he got the endorsement of the SEIU. And this guy is pandering to hardcore democratic socialists in order to implement an agenda that is completely driven by hedge funds and pouring that money into centralization of control of water and energy, directing it into solutions such as infill and rationing and renewable energy. And it's just going to make things more expensive. And that will suit the transactional motivations of his true backers. And it's deceiving everybody else. And then it'll be the same Democratic playbook. Well, you know, things are worse, but it's actually the corporations that are at fault. Tom Steyer is a horrible choice for governor. And that's actually why a lot of people are starting to gravitate to Javier Becerra. And it's interesting when you think about Javier Becerra, because Javier Becerra is being marketed to Californians the same way Joe Biden was being marketed in 2020 to Americans. You know, you have a guy that's sort of old Uncle Joe. You remember the moderate, the sane, you know, guy that'll steer a steady course. He's not crazy like Bernie Sanders. That's what's going on with Javier Becerra versus Tom Steyer. So we don't know which one of them's going to be on the ballot. But it'll probably be one of those two. Matt Mahan is the other choice of a lot of people that are scared of Steyer, but he just doesn't seem to be advancing in the polls fast enough. I mean, voting's already started. But Javier Becerra is going to be more of the same. You'll get a little bit of reform again, because they, you know, but it's going to take too long. You need a governor who's willing to go in there and shake things up, and that's going to take a Republican.
We're talking with the Watermaster, Edward Ring, and you're right, Tom Steyer has now been endorsed by the teachers union after...
Well, they did get him.
Yeah, after crazy Eric Swalwell dropped out, when who knows what's going to happen with that guy. Edward, if there's not a change, I don't know if small farming can survive with the way we're going right now, if we get the same type of governor in.
Well, you know, you're right, because one of the realities, and I'm not a farmer, but I think that farmers would agree, as the water tables drop, the more money you have, the deeper you can afford to dig your well. So you get a consolidation in the agricultural sector, because the only organizations that can afford to drill, you know, 1,000-foot or 1,500-foot or 2,000-foot deep wells are the big operations. And that's where they really have to bring surface water back, you know, and that's where we talk about dredging as, I think, a prerequisite to almost anything else that you're going to do to try to get these allocations increased. But if you look at the water over the last 7 years, we had 3 years of drought, and then that's been followed by 3 years of very plentiful rainfall and snowpack. And then this year has been well above average in rainfall, hasn't been that much of a snowpack, but all of the reservoirs are full, and they should be figuring out how, when you have very wet years, to get every bit of that excess water somewhere. Get it stored in the reservoirs upstream from the delta, or get it into floodplains north or south of the delta where it can go into aquifers and get banked, or allocate it to the farmers and let them have surface water so they can recharge their aquifers at the same time as they're growing crops. And that's not possible yet. And again, that's why I come back to dredging, because I do think dredging, it's not just dredging the South Delta channels. You have to do that just to prevent it from getting even worse, because when those channels dry up, those pumps are turned off. So you've got to get those channels deeper. You got to start right there. But you can dredge, for example, Snodgrass Slough. Right? That's what it's called. There's something called the Sacramento Delta Bypass. It's up on the north end of the delta, and it's got a gate on it. And it is, when they open that gate, they move water from the Sacramento River into the delta. And the slough that connects almost directly from that bypass southward to the forebay, the Clifton Court forebay, where the pumps are, is Snodgrass Slough. And there's others. I'm oversimplifying this, but if you dredged some of those channels as well, you would make it possible to move water through the delta without having so much saltwater intrusion. And then they can do things to manage the tidal energy that actually the more when the tide goes up and during high tide, the saltwater comes into the delta, the more they want to push water through the delta to keep the salt water from coming in too far where the cities and farms can't use the water if it gets too salty. But if you were able to manage that tidal energy, and there's a lot of ways that they've got to do that, they're all controversial, but they're all very practical, that would also take pressure off of having to push so much water through the delta. And the other thing, of course, is all of these cities need to go to tertiary treatment because they're dumping a bunch of phosphorus and nitrogen into the bay. It causes dead zones, and they blame it on climate change instead of fixing their sewage treatment plants. So there's a lot of things that have to change.
And what about other projects like desalinization, and how could California benefit from, you know, advancing that technology and implementing it, especially in our coastal cities?
I'm glad you asked that, because there's still, and I think it's diminishing, but there's still a lot of either or mentality, and we shouldn't think that way. In other words, if we invest in the Delta to get more water south from the Delta, that shouldn't come at the expense of desalination plants. And if we invest billions of dollars in desalination plants, that shouldn't come at the expense of fixing some of these management issues and project investments we need to make in the Delta. There's a lot of potential for desalination, and we're not thinking big enough. A lot of people say, well, desalination isn't going to make that much of a difference. And they look at Carlsbad, which, you know, it's 50,000 acre feet a year. That's a lot for cities. It's not all that much for farmers. I mean, what is 50,000 acre feet a year? That would be 20,000 acres, 15,000 acres. And we've got 5 million acres in the San Joaquin Valley that we're concerned about. So, you know, all right, 50,000 acre feet isn't that much, but 1 million acre feet would be. And 1 million acre feet of capacity, fresh water per year off the California coast would require an investment of about $15 billion. And you know who's going to pay that $15 billion? Nevada and Arizona, because they will get water from the Colorado River for basically for free in exchange for the cost of building these plants. And that comes out to about $1,000 per acre foot of capacity and a, you know, 4% loan, 20 years. So we have, and it's already starting, we have an opportunity where the other Colorado Basin states will provide the financing, which means the ratepayers in California only have to spend money on the operations. Most of the operating cost is energy. And even at 30 cents a kilowatt hour, it's only about $800 per acre foot. So when you look at the split where you have a ready source of financing, construction financing, and then you have ratepayers that are, you know, it's going up. It's $2,500 an acre foot is the wholesale price of water in Los Angeles County. And that's going to go up by 5 to 10% a year for the next several years because they have so much stuff they have to rebuild. Their water infrastructure is 100 years old in some places, and it's aging everywhere. So they've got to invest all this money on wastewater recycling and on restoring their water mains and their whole distribution infrastructure. That's expensive water. When you've got water that you can desalinate with somebody else paying the financing cost, which is the biggest portion of the cost, stick a straw in the Pacific Ocean and desalinate 1 million acre feet a year. And there's environmentalist objections. I don't want to use up all the time here. If you like, we can go through all of that. But the energy cost, the environmental impact, and the financing for large-scale desalination in California has been resolved, and we ought to be getting on with it.
Well, and from an environmental perspective, I'm glad you brought up the Colorado River system because, you know, the same people that are saying that desalinization, they have environmental concerns about it. Like, do they not see what's happening with the Colorado River and the fact that it doesn't even reach the ocean anymore because we're sucking so much water out of it? And so how do they make that argument that, you know, desalinization would be bad when we could make Los Angeles, you know, water self-sufficient and help, you know, restore some of that Colorado River while also providing more water for states like Nevada and Arizona?
Well, you're absolutely right. And the opportunity, I mean, Orange County, if they had gotten the Huntington Beach desalination plant proposal approved, would have been water self-sufficient already. 3 million people on the California coast would have been getting all the water they need from a combination of wastewater recycling. They already recycle 100% of their wastewater in Orange County, local runoff, and desalination. That's an amazing accomplishment. San Diego's close to that. It's going to take longer in Los Angeles County because it's a really, really big place and there's a lot of demand there, but it's achievable. You know, the runoff in Los Angeles County, you know, they'll get 10 inches of rain in a day and it hits the San Gabriel Mountains, and it's 30 miles from the mountains to Long Beach. So you how do you process that? How do you get all of that runoff harvested? But they're getting better and better at harvesting runoff in Los Angeles. The combination of wastewater treatment, runoff harvesting, and desalination to add the missing piece. You know, it serves up the potential where they actually have so much water, they would be exporting water. They could actually send water back over the Tehachapi or back up the Colorado Aqueduct to help refill the Salton Sea or whatever. There's about 800,000 to 1 million acre feet of Colorado River water goes into the Los Angeles Basin in Orange County every year, mostly Los Angeles, and a lot of it goes to San Diego. But you could give that whole 800,000 acre feet back, and then they could decide what they want to do with it. Some of it will save Phoenix and Vegas, where they need more water. They're desperate for more water. Some of it can go back to the ocean. But to say that it wouldn't help the environment is crazy, because the environmental upside of all of those things greatly outweighs the impact of putting those intakes and putting that brine back in the ocean. They can get all the chemicals out of the brine with modern desalination technology. You're just looking at water that's twice as salty. But what you do is you put it out under pressure into the California Current, and you're talking about, you know, a teaspoon in a Olympic swimming pool. I mean, it's probably less than that. It's like one in several billion in terms of its actual impact. And the local environment, the current, we have an upwelling current because our continental shelf drops off abruptly in California. We also have a north-south current, the California Current. That brine, which is merely a little bit saltier water, is dispersed immediately. The environmental impact is negligible.
We're talking with the water master himself, Edward Ring, the Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. Edward, Josh, you guys are funny, because we're talking California. Let's say, for example, dredging the Delta is $8 billion budget. But you know what's going to happen? The Seagull Foundation is going to want a piece of the action. The Fish Foundation, the Green People, the Kangaroo Rat Foundation, they're all going to want a piece of the action, because they have to study this dredging of the Delta before a penny goes into fixing it. That's what's the problem with California. We have a spending issue. Nothing gets done.
Well, that's true, and that's true for everything. And, you know, even the Democrats are waking up to how bad it's gotten. Their solutions, which Steyer embodies, you know, infill, water rationing, renewable energy, are hideous. You know, you can't get there with those kinds of solutions. You're not going to fix housing. You're not going to rescue agriculture, and you're not going to bring down the cost of housing with those kinds of solutions. You're just going to make the people that have connections into those industry sectors richer. That's all you're going to do. And you're going to make ratepayers and consumers and taxpayers cover the cost. So when you talk about the process gumming up the works, you're talking about a systemic failure that's stopping everything from really getting done in California. You know, there's nothing wrong with adding a little bit of funding for creating some habitat at the same time as you do dredging, if it's reasonable. I think everybody wants to do that. But when most of the money goes into, as you say, endless studies and litigation and constant requirements for redesigns, and then you have situations where everything's lined up, everything gets approved, and one of the CEQA lawsuits, you know, from a remote place, you know, is upheld, the whole process starts over again. All of this has to get fixed. This is why we need a governor that's going to be willing to be very aggressive And again, I don't see that coming out of the Democrats. It's too transactional for the Democrats. There's a lot of people in California that are benefiting from this system.
Edward Ring, if Steve Hilton does become our new governor, will you be on his team?
Well, I certainly will if he wants me to. he's got some pretty good people working with him. I know that, remember John Duarte, I think most people recall. John was a congressman, but got beat by 187 votes on like day 38 of the 40-day time period they allow for carrying ballots. He lost by 187 votes. But what made John run for Congress, he's an orchardist. He grows seedlings and sells them to fruit and nuts to the growers throughout California. He's got a big nursery. He's also had some orchards, and he was disking some land that he owned. And the Army Corps of Engineers under Obama attacked him for it. And so he sued them. And he burned through a lot of money. I won't say how much. Leave that up to him. But it was a substantial amount of his fortune. And he won. And immediately, of course, the government turned around and appealed, at which point, he didn't have the resources to do it again. But as his revenge, he got elected to Congress. And I'm sorry that he's not still there. But John knows a lot about water and agriculture, of course, and he's helping Steve. And I'm working with both of them. But there's a lot of people Steve's attracted to his team that I think would really, they're very determined to not come in the way, for example, Javier Becerra would, where it's just business as usual.
Edward, before we get into the oil and gas fiasco in California, anything else you want to talk about when it comes to the water side of things? Heading into the summer, what do we need to look for? Because the allocations on the west side is still 20%, and just not right.
Well, it's not right. And if you look at the flow through the Delta, it's amazing. The outflow. Okay, let me give you the first wet year we had, and that was the wettest. That would have been the water season ending in September of 2023. 27 million acre feet went to the ocean, and 5 million acre feet was pumped by the state and federal pumping plants combined. The following year, 18 million acre feet went to the ocean and 4 got pumped. The following year, that would be the year ending September 2025, 19 million acre feet went to the San Francisco Bay and 4.5 million acre feet got pumped south. This year, and it's a little early, I'm just looking through the end of April, so it's a little early, but 12 million acre feet's gone out to the San Francisco Bay and 2.5 million acre feet's gotten pumped south. And the real question is, how much is enough? If you've got 27 million acre feet going out to the ocean, even the Public Policy Research Institute has a study from 2017, at least. I bet they've revised it since then, but they claim that's all you need is 12 million acre feet. So what if we figured out how to get all of that water reserved somewhere? And that's where we need more surface storage. It's where we need more floodplains where we can bank groundwater. That's really important. We need to be running those pumps at 50% of capacity year round. If we did that, we could bring in 6 million. We could pump down south 6 million acre feet a year. If we were just bringing the water that was in excess of 15 million acre feet going out to the ocean the last three winters, we could have been delivering almost 5 million acre feet a year instead of what we've averaged over the last 7 years is only 3.4 million acre feet a year. And that's not enough. There was plenty of water in those three wet years, and there's plenty of water this year to pump more. So we have to change the regulations. I'll tell you what has to happen. You've got to get the agricultural industry to unify, and that might require farmers working among themselves more and not letting their trade associations fight each other to see who the last man standing is. You can't have the East fighting West, North fighting South. You can't have the grape growers fighting the fruit growers fighting the row crops. Everybody has got to unify behind an agenda that's going to demand reform to the laws. If you just change the management laws, governing the Delta, you could get this water back without having to even start investing in projects. And then you have to prioritize which projects come first. I like dredging in the South Delta because there seems to be a growing consensus for that. And they have to unify. And then the industries that are outside of agriculture need to join with agriculture. Everybody who scratches the ground, every resource-based industry in this state needs to unify behind some common agendas of deregulation. That would include the logging industry, the mining industry, the fishing industry, agriculture, and energy. And they need to work together. And if they did that, and they had realistic plans and stood behind them and targeted politicians that wouldn't support their agenda and would support politicians who did, now you're talking about a critical mass that can stand up to the coalition of special interests that have been running this state into the ground for the last 20 years.
We're talking with Edward Ring, the Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. So if we do get the right leadership in governor, what happens? Does Sigma still happen? Can we change Sigma? Because people are just looking at the future. Oh, Sigma's coming. It's coming.
Well, Sigma, I mean, where do you fine tune Sigma? I mean, there is a fact that I think everybody agrees with, and that is, we've actually we've significantly damaged some of our aqueducts from subsidence. And that shouldn't have happened. And it wouldn't have happened if they'd gotten the surface water that they were contracted to get. But that's happened. And the bottom line is we've got to spend hundreds of millions of dollars. We've come a long way already to fix the Kern Canal. But there's work that has to be done on the California Aqueduct and other channels because they are subsided and they can't transport as much water as they were designed to transport. I think that's enough evidence right there that at some point you have to manage how much groundwater you pump out. That's a tough reality, and I don't think we can ignore it. So then the question is, all right, how are we going to implement that? And that's where it gets extremely controversial, Nick, and I'm not qualified to say which portions of the Groundwater Management Act are right and which ones are wrong. I think there's broad agreement that we've got to do something. And from there, it's a question of, well, how and when do we implement it? And why won't we increase the allocations in the meantime to make it more feasible? Why aren't we pumping a maximum amount that our aqueducts can still handle onto any farmer's land who's willing to percolate and then recharge their groundwater during the winter without it affecting their subsequent allocation? Why does it take so long to streamline those applications? They've made a little bit of progress making it easier to get floodwater allocations for groundwater recharge without, having to go through all kinds of delays, expensive delays, where by the time you get the permit, it's too late. But that has to be accelerated. So I can't really answer that question, Nick, other than to say we know that there is a problem with subsidence. We can't ignore it. So the question is, how can we make sure that it's that the changes that we want to make are done in a reasonable way?
All I know is if I'm the next governor of the state of California, John Duarte is a really good friend of our show. We love him. We love Edward Ring. You two would be on my team. You two could figure it out by the time the dessert comes at lunch. Okay, because it's common sense. Forget about Republican, Democrat, Independent. We're talking common sense of California. We have to figure out this water thing for the future. We got 40 million people and growing. You keep building houses. They need water, right, Edward? So you two would be on my team.
Well, the idea that we can't have abundant water is flawed. It's just not true. John Duarte has been working on this, and we've worked a little bit in parallel and a little bit together. And he's got additional ideas about how more water could come out of the Delta. And these are important ideas because, even if you run the pumps full time, you could get 11 million acre feet pumped south. But you'd have to run them 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And I don't think anybody thinks that that's feasible, right? You have to go, okay, well, what if it was 50% of the time? That would be still great. You know, that'd be 5 or 6 million acre feet a year. But what if we want more than that? What if we need more than that? Because we're finally figuring out how to harvest and bank either on the surface or subsurface all of the big runoffs that we get in these wet years. I mean, you're looking at 17 million, 18 million, 27 million acre feet going out to the ocean in the last three water seasons. What if we knew how to get that water and harvest it because it's not necessary for the ecosystems? The aqueducts aren't enough. So John's been talking about, for example, and I'm sure he's mentioned this on your program, the Folsom South Canal. Why isn't that canal extended all the way to the Clifton Court Forebay so that you could run those pumps all the time, because you'd have another source of water going into them that isn't pulling water directly out of the Delta? And why aren't we tapping in to Folsom and the Folsom Reservoir and the American River, the McCollumney River, the Cosumnes River? Why aren't we tapping those rivers on the way via the Folsom South Canal to get them into the Clifton Court Forebay? So those kinds of projects are very important. And John's been thinking about that a great deal. And there's already, as I understand it, engineering plans to do that. The areas that would have to be traversed is an additional 20 miles. It's a 26-mile canal that ends. It just dead ends. They already built more than half of it. And it's used for groundwater recharge and local agriculture. But not much water is put into this big canal because they never finished it. So those kinds of things need to also be on the table.
That was part one of our tremendous interview with Edward Ring, the Director of Energy and Water Policy at California Policy Center. Now we're going to get into oil and gas, and Edward is on his game with oil and gas. Here we go. Edward Ring, if we could just stop all the fraud in California, all the stealing of money in California, we got plenty of money for programs like this. Potter Valley, let's save some dams up there. We can go on and on.
Yeah, now, we could.
You're, and I know Josh gets fired up about the oil and gas of California because we bring oil and gas all the way across the world, but we're supposed to have the green part of California. Let's talk about oil and gas now because it's a mess. We got the gas tax in California. Let's start with oil and gas. What would Edward do if you were the governor to bring back where people can afford gas at the gas pumps?
Well, you can't do anything about the world price of crude oil. So a lot of the things that, you know, made sense before the war will make sense again as soon as that gets resolved. But the first thing we have to do is stop importing it. We're importing, I double-checked this statistic because I couldn't believe it, but we're already up to 20% of our gasoline, refined gasoline, is being imported. And those supply lines are, I mean, let's set aside for a minute the disruption caused by the war. We are importing refined gasoline, refined to unique California standards from refineries in Asia. And that adds 50 cents to a dollar to the price of gasoline right there. Now that's 20% of the supply, so it doesn't directly translate to that much additional cost. But the more we start importing refined gasoline, we're going to have a new driver of increased prices per gallon. And the reason we're doing that is because we shut down two refineries, and we now produce less refined gasoline in the state than we need, than the demand. If you talk about crude oil, let's take the most optimistic environmentalist scenario, our state's own numbers. They know that between now and whenever they think they're going to get to net zero, we're going to consume in this state another 5 billion barrels of crude oil, 5 billion barrels. And we're importing about 400 million barrels a year, and we're producing barely 100 million barrels a year. Those are very rough numbers, but they're accurate. You can check them. And why aren't we producing that gas here? There's an estimated 30 billion barrels of oil left in the ground in California. If you just look at Los Angeles, and this is USGS surveys, I mean, I'm not getting this from some obscure source. They estimate, the USGS survey estimates that there's 5 billion barrels of oil, recoverable oil, just in Los Angeles County. And the most fascinating thing about this that you don't hear about a lot is the fact that this oil underground is the biggest source of the methane and volatile organic compound leaks. In other words, all of this fuss about shutting down the whole drilling every drilling operation in Los Angeles County to preserve air quality is nonsense. Those active wells are not the source of VOCs and methane. It's natural seepage because you've got such a high density of oil down there underground in Los Angeles, and you also have active geology. It's, you have seismic instability. You get every time there's a little trembler, another vent is opened up and more natural seepage occurs. And what's happening is they cap these wells. Some of these wells are 100 years or older, and they're in like in Beverly Hills, and nobody even knows where the well was. But the methane is coming out of the ground, and it's not just from capped wells. It's just from natural vents in the Earth's surface. And the only way you're going to get that under control is by depleting those fields. So you could actually improve the air quality in Los Angeles if you drilled for more oil. And that's a fact. I mean, that's so contrarian, it's kind of funny. But we could actually improve air quality in Los Angeles. We wouldn't have those oil tankers sitting offshore belching smoke into the air. That's one of the largest sources of air pollution in the Los Angeles basin, is all of these tankers that are just right offshore belching fumes into the air. And then the westerlies coming off the ocean blow it all into the basin where it gets trapped and pollutes the air.
We're talking with the legendary water master, Edward Ring. He's the director of water and energy policy at the California Policy Center. He knows his stuff. Now, Edward, we're good friends of the Taft community, Kern County. You just said Los Angeles County. They got plenty of oil. Do you think the next governor will bring it back? Because if we don't get the right people, are we just going to continue to get oil from Saudi Arabia and wherever else?
Well, it's inexplicable. It's incredibly hypocritical, first of all. Again, we're going to use another 5 billion barrels. The fastest phase out you can possibly imagine is still going to require that much consumption over the next 10 to 20 years. So if we're going to use that much oil, why wouldn't we deplete our own reserves so that we can improve our air quality and employ tens of thousands of people with really good jobs? Why wouldn't we do that? I mean, we have the cleanest, you know, most strictly regulated oil drilling and refining industry in the world. We're the best. We really know how to do it in a way that's as environmentally responsible as you can possibly make it. And in Kern County, you know, first of all, the energy interests in California, especially oil, they've got to stick together. And I'm not saying they didn't, but what was it? Senate Bill 237 authorized more permitting, and it's mainly benefiting Kern County. But not only is that restricted to Kern County, and I'm glad that they've got that, but it's not enough even for Kern County, because they have to frack most of the oil in Kern County. And again, the state legislature has access to bad information, because the fracking process in California, with the kind of geology they've got in Kern County, does not have the same kind of environmental impact that it has in Texas or Oklahoma, where it's a completely different geology. They have to have wells pretty close together. The deposits have to be loosened up with fracking, but it doesn't affect the surrounding strata. It doesn't affect the aquifers the way it potentially can. And I'm not by any means an expert on this, certainly not in the case of Texas. But the point I'm making, and I know this is true, I've talked with a lot of people that are, you know, petroleum geologists involved in Kern County. The fracking doesn't hurt, but it's against the law still in California. And that has to be fixed before they can really unlock production again in Kern County.
We're talking with Edward Ring, the water and oil master. I'm going to call you because you are on your game. You look at can California save the oil industry? Because I know Taft is shriveling up. That is a big, big, beautiful town, but jobs are going away. When jobs go away, people have to move out. There's going to be nothing left. Can we save California on the oil and gas industry?
Well, we've got to get busy. And I think that, again, this is where the resource industries in California need to support each other. And they need to support or target politicians based on whether those politicians are going to help all of these industries with an agenda that they can agree on or not. And, you know, I've been to Taft, and I agree with you. It's a beautiful town, and it's inspiring to look at the history that's behind that town. And what's happening in California is a lot of the people that operate drilling rigs and a lot of the skilled workers that, you know, that are actually working on those rigs, they're leaving. The big companies are going to places like Africa and Brazil, and some of the other, you know, more wildcat companies and the big ones, they're going to Texas, South Dakota, Pennsylvania, and they may never come back. So, you know, because you can't just fix it for one administration. When you will invest in something like an oil field, you need to be able to know and have confidence that they're not going to turn around the next time a new governor comes to town in Sacramento and shuts you down. You've got to know that you're going to have 20 or 30 years to recover your investment. So it's very hard, and a lot of people are saying that the oil industry in California is on the verge of collapse because they lost the San Pablo pipeline because there was no demand anymore at the refinery in Benicia, which cut the amount of demand for that pipeline roughly in half, and it was already underserved. And there's only so much, you know, you can't operate a pipeline if you're only running it at 10 or 15% of its pumping capacity. There's not enough in the pipe to move it forward. So they shut that thing down. And the other thing, of course, is not enough revenue. If you're only using a pipe at 20% of its capacity, you have to raise the rates for anybody to push oil through that pipe to a point where it's not economic for the people that want to use the pipeline. And that's the only way the people that are operating the pipeline can stay in business. You know, you can't demand companies lose money. And that's one of the biggest problems in California. That's how come the insurance companies mostly got out of California. And now it's why the oil companies are getting out.
We talked previously about how if Steyer becomes governor, how detrimental that could be to California. Can you talk specifically on the energy industry in California and what a Steyer victory would look like for that?
Well, I can talk about some of it. Thankfully, haven't immersed myself too far into Steyer. I mean, he's for single payer health care, which is everybody knows that doesn't work. He wants to do anything the teachers union asks for. So he's just going to give them a free hand. And we know what that's done to our K-12 education. He he's a businessman. And so some of this, you got to wonder what he really, really thinks. The oil industry under Tom Steyer is just going to continue to be attacked. One of the things that rational, you know, proponents for renewables, it's ruthless, but it's rational. They understand that if you create energy scarcity, you raise the price for everything. And when you raise the price for everything, you create opportunities for products that otherwise can't compete. And I'm talking about solar energy in particular. And you know, the cost of actually generating energy from a photovoltaic panel, now that China's, you know, pumping them out by the trillions, it's not that expensive, but it's everything else that you need. You've got to have batteries to buffer the power, and you've got to build all of these connections to all these decentralized solar farms. So when you have what's called the total system cost, it's still not competitive. That's why electricity is 30 cents a kilowatt hour in California, when it's the national average is 15 cents a kilowatt hour. And Tom Steyer claims he's going to drop the cost of electricity by 50% so that it'll meet the national average. And he says he's going to do that by making utilities compete. But I haven't seen any details on exactly how he proposes to accomplish that, because the way that you would drop the price of electricity in California is by leaving our natural gas power plants on. In other words, if we were allowed, our natural gas power plants, to the extent they haven't been shut down, are operating at less than 30% of capacity. The only time they're allowed to operate is when there's not enough battery storage or there's not enough solar or wind energy. All of these projects are not cost effective yet, and some of them never will be. But natural gas power, especially from power plants that are allowed to operate all the time, they could sell electricity into the grid at a wholesale price that would be much cheaper, and it would be much cheaper 24 hours a day. Yes, solar energy is it's virtually free during noon on a summer day in California, but it's not in the middle of winter at night when you need all kinds of energy for lighting and heating and everything else that we use electricity for. And they want to get EVs on the road. And how are EVs going to get powered? That's another 100,000 gigawatt hours if we electrify our transportation fleet. Did I say 100? Yeah, 100,000 gigawatt hours a year is what it would cost us. We use about 300,000 gigawatt hours a year right now. And then look what he's going to do with offshore wind, floating offshore wind. They want to put 20 gigawatts of output out in the ocean, and they want to have it floating 20 miles offshore in 4,000 feet of water with tethering cables going down, you know, nearly a mile to the ocean floor. These things, each of them, you're looking at, they're planning on having 12 megawatt turbines, so you'd need about 2,000 of them. And can you imagine 2,000 floating turbines that are each 1,000 feet high from the bottom of the pontoon to the tip of the rotor? Can you imagine putting that mess into the Pacific Ocean? And we've looked at the numbers, their own numbers. That would be 40 cents a kilowatt hour cost. That would be the wholesale cost before you distribute any of that electricity. That's stunning. And Steyer is going to push that kind of stuff. And they hide behind climate change as their rationale for all of that. But what it really is heavily subsidized major corporations using climate change to force these mandates onto California's consumers. And Steyer epitomizes that.
We're talking with Edward Ring, the Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. Well, we do know if the top two are Steve Hilton and Chad Bianco, there's going to be a change in California. If it is Bianco or Steve Hilton versus a Democrat, don't know if that's going to happen. So, Edward, do you think people are finally waking up and saying, listen, we got to have a change here? Or will they go in the ballot or the booth and just say, up, it's a D, got to vote Democrat, and nothing's going to change? Or you think people are getting smarter now, like, we can't be living like this anymore?
Well, you know, I don't know how much broadcast television you watch. We tend to sit through a little bit here and there, and we can see the commercials that are saturating the airwaves right now because we're in the middle of a primary. And it's fascinating. Well, it's actually kind of sickening as well. The Democrat commercials are all, I will stand up to Donald Trump. And that's their, you know, and you see, you hear this on the debate stage as well, right? The Bianco and Hilton are both very good at reminding viewers of these debates that that's all the Democrats have got. That's all they're falling back on is we're not Trump. They're, you know, they're part of MAGA and they're bad because they're affiliated with Donald Trump. And if you say that often enough to California's electorate, there's a possibility that it's going to blind them to all of these real issues. So that's the downside. And that's sort of the scary part of it. But the encouraging part of it, hopefully, is that there's a lot of people in Los Angeles who lost their homes, and the people in Altadena and the people in Pacific Palisades can't build them again. And I'm sure you're familiar with the campaign of Spencer Pratt, who's somebody who lost his home. And if you look at his campaign for mayor in Los Angeles, I think you're looking at the next generation of campaign ads. He's using artificial intelligence to turn Karen Bass and Gavin Newsom into, you know, clowns from the movie Joker, sitting at a table like the elite aristocrats right before the French Revolution. You know, he's using extremely vivid imagery to convey fairly sophisticated ideas, which is the fact that Democrats actually represent oligarchs. They're an aristocracy. The elite Democrats that run California are an aristocracy. They're all wealthy, and they are all getting wealthier on a basis of the policies of scarcity that they're implementing on everybody else. Now, if Spencer Pratt can perform really well in the mayor's race, because there's so many wealthy Democrats that are suddenly homeless and are encountering this ridiculous bureaucracy that's preventing them from rebuilding their homes, you could start to see some realignment, because now you've got people who, you know, work in Hollywood, who are communications and entertainment who have a lot of money and a lot of influence, who are homeless and they can't rebuild their homes. And they're seeing the whole game. They're seeing how they're going to go in there and try to replace private homes with subsidized so-called affordable housing, which even the Democrats in the debates admit. Why is it $800,000 a unit? Why is it that the private developers can build a unit for less than half that cost, even here in California? They're starting to witness the corruption firsthand. It's hitting them. It's hitting them directly. It's made them homeless. So maybe there's a wave that Hilton and Bianco are part of, that we're all part of, that's going to get joined by this wave coming out of Los Angeles. And if that were to happen, and if that could be sustained, we might realign the state. I don't know if it's going to happen this year or 2 years from now or whenever, but, you know, it looks like there could be change. There could be a realignment, because people could realize maybe what a scam we've been living under.
And Edward, if we could get the right governor in office, what policy or policies would you immediately prioritize if you were advising them on energy policy in California?
that's fun. If I was able to convince the governor to do a few things right away, I think the first thing I would do is identify every single executive in every single agency in the state government that's involved with water and energy that's doing a poor job. And I would identify every board director that the governor has control over, or the secretary of resources has control over, that's doing a poor job. And I would have them fired immediately, right away, like first week, bye-bye. And replace those people with people that are pro-abundant, genuine pro-abundance advocates that are expert in their fields, and would start to try to twist these biased, scarcity-oriented bureaucracies back towards rational energy and water policies. It would be an awful fight, but I think you have to start right there.
Well said. I think you have to just fire everyone and start over, just like the fraud in California. We're talking with Edward Ring, the Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center, because if we don't get the right person in the next governor, the fraud will continue. There'll be no audit. It'll just continue, because I think something has to give. The great taxpayers of California have to say, listen, enough's enough. Our money's just being dwindled away. Something has to change. I want people to realize what Edward's saying. It's now or never right now for California.
Well, you know, another reason it's now or never is we have a very unique opportunity with the federal administration. And for all of the things that they say about Trump, you know, they demonize Trump so much. But if you talk with people that are involved in the Trump administration, and you just sit down and listen to the stories that they will tell you about what they're uncovering in the federal bureaucracy, it's stunning. The level of corruption and waste is, you know, and you're going to have that in any government. I mean, governments attract power, is, you know, it's a source of power and money, and people that like power and money are going to go into government, and corruption can never be entirely eliminated. But the way it's gotten so out of hand is really stunning. The other thing, and so they're going to fix some of that. And hopefully, if we keep, I know I'm being partisan here, but I sincerely believe Republicans care more about the working man than Democrats do. And I also believe they care more about the environment than Democrats do. And we could talk about that a lot. But the point I'm trying to get to is the federal administration has ways to force the state of California to invest in some of these projects. And one example of that we saw was Salem Energy? The offshore oil rigs on the Santa Barbara coast, off the Santa Barbara coast, are operating again. That's 50 million barrels of oil a year come out of those wells. They're very productive wells. That increased California's oil production by not quite 50%, almost overnight. And the federal government made California accept that. And there are ways the federal government can make California accept large-scale desalination. In fact, we've done some research into that, and there are provisions in existing legislation like the Submerged Land Act, Coastal Zone Management Act. Both of these pieces of federal legislation have provisions left in them that allow the federal government to preempt state law. And one of the ways, we saw it in Vandenberg, actually, where the Coastal Commission got slapped down. But we could also see that with desalination. And we could see that with other things relating to water and energy in California. So a governor that comes in that's willing to work with the federal government instead of just standing up on the grandstand and beating his chest and saying, I'm launching this lawsuit and I'm protecting your freedom and I'm protecting democracy and all this BS, which has absolutely no productive value. A lot of them behind the scenes are actually starting to work with the federal government a little bit, but you really need to see more of that. And if we were willing to work with the federal government, especially now when they're trying to get things done, that would also really help California get energy and water abundance restored. I think we have a real opportunity right now. And, you know, if we hang on to Congress, if we have another Republican president, that's going to continue. But we don't know what the future holds. We have an opportunity right now.
Edward Ring, I really believe we need a great relationship with the federal government, because right now, if we don't, we're going to be on an island. And I tell people all the time, if Trump is so bad here in California, then why isn't the rest of the United States in disarray? They're not. This is all man-made in California. Every issue we have is a man-made issue. Forget about Donald Trump, but we need a relationship with the federal government.
We do. And I think that, you know, the tightrope that Bianco and Hilton have to walk is pretty daunting, because on one hand, they don't want to convey, you know, who's going to vote for Steve Hilton, for example. I think Steve Hilton probably has a little bit better chance because and you know, it's sad, because what helps him with the independents and disaffected Democrats hurts him with Republicans that are very principled and don't want any compromise. You know, Bianco's more that he's their guy. And so what Hilton has to put together, and what Bianco is also trying to do, is a perception that they're not, you know, part of the MAGA cult, because that's the stereotype that's being used very effectively against them. And so they have to, on one hand, say, no, I'm not part of the any kind of cult, but, you know, and then they have to present the reasonable argument, but it's in our interests to work with the federal government. So that's a tightrope, but you know, I think they're doing as the best they can. It's a real open question. The Republican Party and the voters have got to unify behind one of those candidates. It's probably going to be Hilton, because he's up to like 23%, and I think Bianco's 22%, and Bianco in the latest survey was 13%. So I'm not saying anything positive or negative about Chad Bianco. I'm just stating he's almost halfway behind Hilton now in the polls. People that support Bianco and some of these other candidates on the right, because it's there's 63 candidates on the ballot, you know, and the other, you know, if you got what, six major candidates, Bianco, Hilton, Steyer, Porter, and Mahan, right? And they're all there, but there's 56 other ones. Yeah, well, 63, 57, 56. Think about that. See, I can't do math, Nick. I'm the math guy. I'm the accountant that came to politics, and I can't subtract 6 from 53, from 63. The point I'm making, okay, is 57 other people are going to get 2 or 3%. And that 2 or 3% might spell the difference between getting elected or getting defeated. And then you got another how many? 5%, 6%, 7% of Bianco voters that aren't going to gravitate to Hilton. And then you have to ask yourself, well, what does Hilton have to do to buy, you know, 5 points off of the registered Democrats and half of the independents so he can get 51% of the voter more? And to what extent, when he does that, is he going to alienate conservatives that like Chad Bianco? So, I mean, I'm not telling you guys anything you don't already know, but it's just kind of disappointing, because we need to have the so-called Big Tent. we need to be willing to say 80% is good enough, because we're getting 20% right now. You know, so you get a candidate that's going to give you 20% of what you want or less, you know, Tom Steyer, or you get a candidate that's they're not perfect. It's an 80-20 choice. It's like people that go, why did you vote for Donald Trump? I go, because I didn't want Kamala Harris. I mean, there were other reasons I voted for Donald Trump. Okay, there are plenty of good reasons, in my opinion. He's not perfect, but by God, I'm so glad he's in the White House and not Kamala Harris. You know, I had the opportunity to visit the White House about a year ago. I was in the West Wing. And as I'm going through there, I'm thinking to myself, can you imagine what it would be like if Biden and Kamala Harris and all of the people they brought in to supposedly run the government were still here making choices and decisions that affect the whole country? It was a terrifying thought, because it really brought it home. You know, the people that are occupying these offices for no other reason than their political allegiance and whatever diversity boxes they check. You know, I don't want to get carried away with this, but that's the Democratic scam, is they hide behind all of these social issues and they hide behind all of these race and gender issues. And in the background, they're like Tom Steyer. They're consolidating wealth and power. They're driving all the little people, the small businesses, the households into insolvency, rolling up all the markets, and they're doing it under the guise of protecting us from climate change and protecting us from racism and sexism and saving democracy. I know I'm sounding extremely partisan right now, but I was there, and I've talked with the people that are trying to fix this country, and they are sincere, Nick, and it's night and day in terms of competence. When you compare this administration to the one that preceded it in Washington.
Absolutely. And so, you know, you have the Democrats are blaming the Trump administration and saying that they're going to stop him if you get them in office. But then we see a lot of other states in the country that are doing really well under the Trump administration. So I feel like that argument kind of falls flat. But do you think that other states like Texas or Florida are becoming more competitive economically, you know, against states like California because of their lower energy costs?
Well, they absolutely are. I mean, energy it's the foundation of so much, right? I mean, it's not just what it costs you to turn the lights on or fill your tank. It's every single product that has to be shipped anywhere requires energy to get it from point A to point B. You know, the cost of fertilizer, the cost of, you know, water, the cost of food. I mean, everything in California costs more. All of the inputs at their foundation rely a lot on how abundant and affordable water and energy is. I mean, that's why it's of great concern to me. And I think that other states are definitely more competitive. What we've got in California, which is never going to go away, though, is a Mediterranean climate. So if California had the climate, and I won't name a state, let's just say if California had a humid climate or a climate that, you know, resembled Siberia in the winter, it would already be empty. You know, no one would put up with this.
We're talking with Edward Ring, the Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. Edward, I say all the time, forget about being a Democrat, Republican, Independent right now. Because I think I look back, even Bill Clinton, JFK would have been probably Republicans today. We're so far divided. But you look right now, Republicans are about 25% registered voters in California. Democrats are 40% or so. 30% are in the middle. We had Elaine Kalati on, who's running for independent, but she's not even going to get a sniff. But there's 30% undecided in California. That's where it's going to be won or lost here in California.
Well, you're right. And when I come across as partisan, because I suppose I am, it's not because I think that, you know, Republicans are necessarily better than Democrats in many historical contexts. And I'll start with California's Pat Brown Sr., the first governor Brown. That guy built the freeways in California, he built the universities, and he built the California Water Project. But they built things back in those days, and Democrats did it. You know, if we had high taxes and they were going to build without corruption the kinds of water and energy infrastructure, the backbone, which government should have a role in funding, you know, I probably wouldn't mind paying a little bit more taxes. But what Democrats nowadays have done is they've realized that if you can create a dependent class and blame it all on corporations and racism, they're going to vote for you forever because they're going to need your government benefits in order to survive, in order for their households to survive economically. That's what it's turned into. And so all of the money that we used to spend on infrastructure, we're spending on social programs. And there's a great irony there, because if we simply deregulated and allowed private industry to compete, they could offer products at affordable prices, including housing. You know, if you deregulate land use and invest money in transportation assets and energy infrastructure and water infrastructure, all of a sudden you have the ability to build more single-family homes on open land. But California's policies are completely opposite that. They discourage that. And you know, if it was Republicans that were doing that and Democrats that were trying to fix it, I'd be a Democrat. You know, it has nothing to do with partisanship, as you say. And if a Democratic politician came along and I believed them when they had an agenda that would be authentically abundance oriented, I'd vote for the Democrat.
Leave your feelings out. That's what we got to start doing. And we need to start looking at solutions for our leaders. Edward, looking at the summer, before we let you go, and thank you so much for hanging out with us today. This has been fantastic. What does the Edward meter say? What's going to look like? What do you think is going to happen heading into the summer with water and the election with the governor?
God. Well, they've got to release more water. But again, you need a unified front. I mean, the farmers have to stand together. I you know, that's impossible to predict, as you know. As far as the, if I was going to predict who the next, who the top two candidates are, and somebody said, you've got to bet, you know, you have to pick, who would it be? I'm kind of figuring it's going to be Hilton and Steyer, and Steyer scares the hell out of me. But there's a possibility it could be Hilton and Becerra. And of course, the nightmare scenario is somehow two of the Democrats surge and two of them fade. And if that happens and, you know, Hilton gets, let's say, 25% of the vote and Bianco gets 15% of the vote, and then you have a pair of Democrats splitting the vote evenly, you could have the nightmare scenario where we have a pair of Democrats running. But the worst thing that could possibly happen is Tom Steyer getting elected.
And of course, Edward, you've written so many great books. How do they get, people want to know, come on, AgMeter, how do we get a hold of Edward Ring? How do they get a hold of you if they want to read your books or follow you?
Well, you can go to the California Policy Center, of course. And we don't, you know, URLs are kind of obsolete. You just type California Policy Center, you'll get it. Similarly, if you just type Edward Ring, you'll see pretty much all the stuff I write come right up on a search engine.
Edward, you're one of the best we have, and we appreciate you taking the time today. Josh, anything else?
That's all I got. Edward, I really appreciate the time. I always enjoy talking to you and picking your brain on all this.
I know you're going to be on one of the governor's teams if it is Steve Hilton or Chad Bianco. There's no doubt about it. We need experts like you. Last question for you. Have you thought about stepping in the political ring? Edward Ring, political ring, get it?
Yeah, I get it. Well, I'll have to get better at my spontaneous addition and subtraction. 63 minus 6 is 57. You know, Nick, I'm already in the political ring.
Yes, you are.
You know, I think that people who run for office, it takes a lot of courage. You want to go into it with a chance to win. I don't think it's helpful. There's a lot of perennial candidates, and they'll take away a couple of points of votes, and then that might, in a close race, spell the difference between someone who can win, not winning. So, you know, I wouldn't get involved as a peripheral candidate like that. I think that it's a tremendous opportunity to be able to just, you know, hopefully have some influence on policy. And that's where I want to focus my effort. And I you know, I'll tell you this, Nick, I wish more people would do what we're doing. We need more analysts in California that are speaking out. You know, the reason I wrote the book, The Analyst's Cookbook, which is my most recent book, was because it provides some sources of information and techniques to look at water and energy policy quantitatively and then write about it and talk about it in a way that isn't too, you know, wonky, isn't too academic. And we need more people doing that. And of course, we need more people to run for office. And we need business people to run for office again. It's just turned into such a toxic environment that a lot of really smart people who ought to run for office don't. They know what they're going to encounter if they try to. They're going to be attacked and slandered, and they're going to have to find a source of funds. California has become a very challenging environment like that. Business people used to run for office, and they used to do very well. But the, you know, the little by little, the center of gravity of California politics kind of shifted over to special interests like public sector unions and trial lawyers and a lot of the you know, crony capitalists, the land developers that get heavily subsidized to build housing at $800,000 a unit, the homeless industrial complex. And these people are profiting off of poverty, and they're profiting off of dysfunction and process instead of results. So
yeah,
we definitely need more people to run for office. I mean, I let you down there, Nick. I don't really want to throw my hat in the ring, but you know, in my area, we've got a really good, we've got Josh Hoover is a really good member of the assembly. So I'm happy with Josh. So there's nothing there. Our senator is also real good, but the, you know, our congressman, somebody's got to beat Ami Bera. I don't think I'm the guy to beat Ami Bera, but you're absolutely right, Nick. We need more people to get involved.
Yeah, we're working on getting Spencer Pratt on here for the, he's running for the mayor of Los Angeles because there's a lot of going on with the oil and gas industry in LA. But if they want to buy your book, how do they get a hold of, how do they buy your book? Because you do such a great job.
Well, let me do it right now. Let me see what comes up. Just go into your browser and type Edward Reed. What happens? Okay. Where are the books? I'm scrolling down. Yeah, Amazon. Scroll down. They're all on Amazon. Edward Ring books, biography, latest update. So, you know, you can find them pretty easily. The one that I think is, there's three of them I think are most useful. One's The Abundance Choice, Our Fight for More Water. The first one, Fixing California, that's kind of a blueprint that when I got involved with Steve Hilton, I relied on that a lot. It's just looking at forestry and education and water and energy and housing and homeless policy and crime. And it's got ideas in all of those areas. And then the most recent one, which I kind of cryptically named The Analyst's Cookbook, that's a manual for people that want to get involved and do this. Talk about water and energy policy and have access to the facts and understand how to pick out the numbers that matter and communicate them in ways that are that are in plain English, so people can kind of start to see the opportunities we have if we just have sane policies.
Well, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, you've just got to spend some time with the greatest we have in California, Edward Ring, the water master, the director of water and energy policy at the California Policy Center. Edward, I can't thank you enough for hanging out with our show because everyone, I get so many emails after you come on. Thank you so much for what you do for California.
Well, we all got to do our best, Nick. So you build me up way too much, but obviously I appreciate that. And I just want to help any way I can.
Edward Ring, thank you.
Thank you, Nick.